Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. The topic again today is a crucially important one. Again, it's Gaza. And my scheduled guest is a very distinguished man, Professor Francis Boyle. He's a human rights expert. He's an international law expert. He teaches at the University of Illinois. He lectures widely. He's written so much, numerous books. In 1987, he was the PLO's legal advisor. He helped them draft their 1988 Declaration of Independence. From 1991 to 1993, he served in the same capacity for the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations that led up to the Oslo process. Haven't seen much peace in that area. That was 1993. My goodness, we're over 15 years later, and things today are more dire than ever, it seems. I also asked Dr. Musa El-Haddad to come back briefly. He's a retired doctor living in Gaza City, and when I reached him briefly this morning, I asked him how he was, and he told me he's still alive, and that's something to be thankful for. Musa, Francis, have I got you both on?
I'm here, Stephen. Happy New Year to everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. Musa, am I connected with you as well?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you. In a couple of minutes, we have our first commercial break. You remember how it works when we hear this soft music that's coming on. But Musa, begin. Explain what's happening now. Israel supposedly declared a ceasefire last Saturday night, 2 in the morning, I believe, Sunday morning. I don't call it a ceasefire. I call it a pause. And, of course, the shooting hasn't stopped. They're still killing Palestinians. But explain what's going on the ground right now.
Well, right now it's quieter than before, but shooting has never stopped. You can hear shooting from the gunships in the sea, and those jets and pilotless flights keep running and flying in the air. They've never stopped, and I think they're probably again they're trying to intimidate and provoke Hamas and other organizations to start probably firing rockets, so to have an excuse to re-attack Gaza again. And it's very clear, because the ceasefire is not really a ceasefire.
Israel never declares a ceasefire. Israel never withdraws. Israel redeploys troops, Musa, you know that.
Yes,
Francis, you know it inside out, upside down. Ceasefires, my goodness, for over six decades, there's never been a ceasefire. Why would anybody believe anything that Israel says now?
Well, the problem is not what has already happened. You know, we have more than 1,300 dead and more than 4,000 injured. But every day now they are pulling up, like day before yesterday they pulled 100 bodies, 25 of Shamuni family alone. The family, which has a tragic, 16 people were killed before. And now every day they are pulling bodies from under the rebels, and I think this will continue for days and days, and the problem that we'll be facing from now on, even if we have a ceasefire, even if they open the borders, even if they lift the siege, the psychiatric problems, the people here, we're going to face, adults and children and women who survived this will go through very bad times psychologically.
Let me interrupt. We need to take a break.
Yes,
let's
okay,
do that, and we'll come right back. To Dr. Musa El-Haddad from Gaza City, and law professor Francis Boyle is also my guest. Musa, let me continue with you just for a little bit, and I know you had a short time, so let me learn from you what we can in that short time. What's happening now? How close did troops come to your home? How close did the bombing and shelling come to your home in your neighborhood.
Came as close as 1 mile or less than that to my home. And now we're discovering how massive the damage is. Today, for the first day, I went out in my car, and oh my gosh! I mean, most buildings are damaged. Now you go to Tell el Hawa. I haven't been to the north and the east yet, but in Tell el Hawa area, almost every house. I'm talking about civilian houses. I'm not talking about Hamas buildings or anything. If the house is not leveled down to the ground, it has at least 4 or 5 huge holes in the walls from missiles from the Apaches and F-16. And now you can hardly find a family that has lost 1 or 2 people, either dead or injured. And as I started initially, every day, people smell some kind of funny smell, so they start digging, they find bodies, 1, 2, 10, doesn't matter. But what I really, I'm surprised, and what surprised me lately, is that there's a very strange scenario here. Israel is allowed to get all the most advanced weapon in the world from the United States and from other countries, F-16, F-17, and God knows what, and weapons that are illegally used, and all this. And at the same time, Ms. Livni and Rice signed a treaty to overlook the sea, the air, and the land, and everywhere in the Middle East, not to allow any simple weapons to go to the resistance group, who are trying to defend their occupied land, which is legal by United Nations law. If you're occupied, you're allowed to defend yourself and trying to free your land. So this is what the street here is talking about right now, and this might be a surprise to you and the whole world, is that although initially Israel wanted to destroy Hamas and to destroy the will of Hamas and the support of people to Hamas, but this came as a big surprise to Israel and even to me. I don't see anybody that says any word against Hamas right now. So the support is increased after this war, so much so that even if elections occur today, I'm sure Hamas will win by a majority now. I had some doubt before this war, but not now.
Well, see, it's no surprise to me, and it's amazing. Hamas is more popular than ever, and what's also amazing is the worldwide protest against what Israel has done. And I think it's continuing. I hope this continues. I've been doing a lot of writing on it to hopefully add my voice to others and have programs like this to keep this story alive. This story has to be kept alive, and Israel needs to be held accountable. And
I don't know why the whole world has to start rebuilding Gaza when Israel has done all the damage. That's number one. And number two, I think all the leaders of Israel should be put on trial in Lahai, just like other people in Eastern Europe happened before.
Just like the Nazis. Francis, this is where you come in, Francis, on putting these criminals on trial.
Well, first I wanted to say hello to Dr. Musa.
Hello, sir.
I know he must have known my client and friend, Dr. Haider Abdul Shafi.
Of course, his soul, yes. He was my best friend, yes.
Yes, and he and I started working together in 1991 at the peace negotiations and continued until his death. And you might recall that actually Dr. Haider and I tried to convince President Arafat not to sign Oslo,
yes.
And we lost out. To
I wish he didn't. Yes.
So, and I was very honored. I had a brief conversation with him before he died. So let us stay in touch. Stephen has the number if you need to get a hold of me.
Yes.
Certainly, as Dr. Moose has said, I've set up a campaign to establish an international criminal tribunal for Israel by the United Nations General Assembly as a subsidiary organ under Article 22 of the United Nations Charter that would be organized along the lines of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia that was set up by the Security Council. Obviously, the United States would veto any effort to set up a tribunal against Israel at the Security Council, but there is no veto in the General Assembly. Basically, all we need is a majority of the 192 votes, and the non-aligned movement has, I think, 118. That doesn't mean all of them are, you know, going to vote in our favor. Now, my proposal was adopted unanimously last week by the parliament in Malaysia. They had a special session there to consider this proposal. It was adopted unanimously, and then they ordered their government to support this proposal all over the world, which they are currently doing. And then in the UN General Assembly debate, just concluded under the Uniting for Peace procedure, Iran supported my proposal. I've been trying to convince the Iranians to support it. Malaysia supported it, and several Muslim states also supported it. So I think there, if we keep the pressure on all these governments, President of the UN General Assembly, Miguel Descoto, has already accused the Israelis of committing genocide against the Palestinians. I believe I have an essay, Stephen, on your website setting forth the legal arguments for that under the 1948 Genocide Convention. You know, I've sent my proposals into his office. There's an international petition circulating. You can find it on, do a Google search to try to get this proposal through the UN General Assembly and put Israel's leaders on trial, Omer, Livni, Barak, Ashkenazi, the head of Mossad, military intelligence, at a minimum, for genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions against the Palestinians, and not just now. I would take it back at least, depending on how far back they want to go. You could take it back to the First Intifada, at least in 1987, which started there in Gaza, or the Al-Aqsa Intifada in September 2000 that was provoked by Ariel Sharon. Obviously, that would have to be negotiated, the time frame, how far back they want to go. Although, I've also argued that it should, if we're going to set this tribunal up, given the massive violations of human rights that Israel has inflicted on the people of Lebanon, it should also include Lebanon too. And there you have the certainly the invasion of 1982. That massacred 20,000 people in Lebanon, including the 2,000 at Sabra and Shatila, Grapes of Wrath, and then, of course, the summer of 2006, where they killed about 1,200 Lebanese. So my, you know, proposal as originally drafted was to deal with both the Palestinians and Lebanon. Now, obviously, that would have to be negotiated at the UN. But it is now on their agenda. I'm sure the United States and Israel and the European Union will fight back furiously against this, and we'll just have to see to what extent the non-aligned movement, the Arab states, the Islamic Conference Organization have some spine in them when it comes to confronting Israel and the United States. I can't predict how this will turn out.
For instance, in my new article that I put out today, I crammed so much into an article, this disparate information, but I think it's important and I want to put it in if it's current. And one thing I had in it was that Israel is worried about the international reaction over the Gaza war, and they have told Israeli officials, IDF top people, government officials, that if they're planning a trip abroad, they should double check to be sure that where they're going, they won't be picked up by security and held on charges like this. And it mentioned in the material that I quoted that in some cases, some people will be advised not to travel.
That is correct. I was to the best of my knowledge, the first person ever to file a lawsuit against an Israeli official for the massacre at Sabra and Shatila back in the mid-1980s. General Yaron, who supervised the massacre of 7 completely innocent completely innocent Palestinian men, women, and children.
Indeed.
And lawsuits have been filed regularly since then. Sorry, we're running out of time. Fine.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Gaza City. Francis, you've also written how the United States, I've got it up on my desktop, how the United States promotes Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. And I've quoted you in some of my articles. Israel commits genocide, and the U.S. is its partner.
That's correct. Under the 1948 Genocide Convention, I think you have that essay on your website if people want to read the argument. I have been trying to get a state to give me authority to sue Israel for the World Court for genocide and seek a temporary restraining order against them over Gaza, similar to the work I did for Bosnia at the World Court against the rump Yugoslavia. Right now, you know, I know the Iranian government and Malaysian government have my proposal under consideration. I don't know what they will or will not do. I guess we'll just have to see. I've also submitted a proposal to President Abbas for me to sue Israel for genocide on behalf of the state of Palestine, but between you and me, I really am not overly optimistic that President Abbas is going to give me that authority.
I would be shocked, Francis. I would be absolutely shocked if he did.
President Abbas is not President Arafat. That's all I can say about this matter.
Indeed.
Arafat, whom I did advise counsel for many years, very well might have given me the authority. But all I can say is President Abbas is not President Arafat, so let's leave it at that.
Let me also correct you, sir. Abbas is not a president anymore, by the way.
Well,
from January 9th.
Well, doctor, let me just say you're the doctor and I'm the lawyer. Technically,
yeah.
He is not the president of the Palestinian Authority, and you are right. Correct on that. However,
yes.
He is president of the state of Palestine. And, in fact, I was the one who did all the legal work for the PLO on their Declaration of Independence and setting up the Palestinian state back in 1988 under President Arafat. So, technically, he can operate internationally as the president of the state of Palestine, which he is currently doing.
Yeah.
But you are right. He is no longer democratically elected by anyone. The president of the state of Palestine, given the circumstances of the time back in 1988 when we set the state up, it was my advice that since it was very difficult for the Palestine National Council to meet, which was and still is the only representative agency for all Palestinian people around the world, it was my advice that we set up the Executive Council of the PLO as the provisional government for the state of Palestine, that is provisional to democratic elections involving all Palestinians around the world.
Yep.
And so it is the executive committee of the PLO then that chose President Abbas to be the president of the state of Palestine. But you are correct. He really has no democratic legitimacy anymore from the Palestinian people, either in occupied Palestine or the diaspora. And in fact, Hamas and Prime Minister Hania have been democratically elected, and that's a somewhat paradoxical situation. Although they were democratically elected by the Palestinians living in occupied Palestine and for the Palestinian Authority, but they have no authority, Hamas, Prime Minister Hania, to speak on behalf of the Palestinian diaspora.
Francis, is what you're saying true, even though Abbas's term formally expired on January 9th, that he will not step down? He wants to
wait. Well, you know, even the Palestinians' leaders refer to me for advice on these matters, and President Abbas hasn't asked me my advice on this matter, but he no longer has authority as the president of the Palestinian Authority. But technically, internationally, he is the president of the state of Palestine operating internationally, yes.
Even though his term expired.
And Palestine has, well, that, you know, the Palestine today has de jure diplomatic relations with about 120 states and observer state status at the United Nations, and I did all that work. It was my idea. So in that capacity, he still remains president of the state of Palestine, although not democratically elected. But he is no longer president of the Palestinian Authority, which only represents occupied Palestine. The state of Palestine represents all Palestinians all over the world, including in the diaspora. In the Declaration of Independence, I put it in there so that all Palestinians anywhere in the world would have automatic Palestinian citizenship without losing any other citizenship they might have acquired. This is a very important, difficult issue. We want to...
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Francis Boyle with Musa El Haddad in Gaza City. Let me mention one thing that both of you may not know too much about. Number one, globalresearch.ca that makes this program possible has a very important article top featured on the website, globalresearch.ca, on the Gaza war now and Lebanon tomorrow, a third Lebanon war. 82 was the first, 2006 the second, and a third planned. And in my new article today, I quote several Israeli generals from material in Haaretz, and one of them is Major General Eland, former head of Israel's National Security Council, and he was very bitter about the 2006 Lebanon War defeat because in his view, it was against the wrong enemy, Hezbollah. This is his quote, the wrong enemy, Hezbollah, instead of the state of Lebanon itself. And then he says, it's impossible to defeat an official guerrilla army supported by a state immune from retribution. Hezbollah operates under optimal conditions from our perspective. A legitimate government runs Lebanon, supported by the West, but it's in fact entirely subordinate to the will of Hezbollah. And then it goes on, and it really pretty strongly suggests that Israel has plans afoot for a third Lebanon war, and it's very hawkish language saying, we didn't really do enough last time. This time we're going to do what we should have done last time, which sounds to me like they want to level the whole country. That's pretty serious stuff.
Well, that's what they did in 1982 under General Sharon. They destroyed the better part of the country and killed 20,000 Lebanese. And that is why in my proposal for this International Criminal Tribunal for Israel, it's very important also to include their crimes against the Lebanese to deter what is obviously going to be another attack on Lebanon. And sure, after their defeat by Hezbollah in 2006, it's a matter of public record. They immediately came back. The Vinograd report tried to figure out what they did wrong. And now they're planning to redo it again. The same thing happened now in attacking Gaza. Remember, in the summer of 2006, they originally started attacking Gaza, and Hezbollah, that's really a national liberation movement, came to the help of the Palestinians. They began to start some border skirmishes to relieve the pressure on the Palestinians. And when that happened, then Israel used that as a pretext to go after Hezbollah. I think Israel's plan was to do that this time, too, that one of the reasons they were literally torturing the Palestinians in front of the entire world and permitting Al Jazeera and Iranian press TV in Gaza, they could have pulled the plugs on those satellites at any time, was that they were trying to encourage Hezbollah to come to the defense of the Palestinians in Gaza, as Hezbollah had done in 2006, so they could take out Hezbollah. And indeed, as we're speaking today, there are large numbers of Israeli troops already mobilized and massed on the border with Lebanon. They had that call-up of reserves. That was not for Gaza. That was for Lebanon. You've had, since the start of the Gaza war, the latest Gaza war, Israeli warplanes flying over Lebanon all the time and trying to provoke Hezbollah. So, sure, this will happen again. It's only a question of time, and indeed also to take out Syria. We know that in the summer of 2006, the neoconservatives in the Cheney administration, when Israel attacked Lebanon, were also encouraging Israel to go after Syria, as they did in 1982. So we still could see sort of a domino effect here, and that could be their strategy: attack Gaza, provoke Hezbollah, attack Lebanon, attack Syria, and then try to get Iran. We know for a fact that they still want to attack Iran.
Oh, there's no question about that. Iran is really Iran is Israel's number one rival in the region. So Iran absolutely is a top target, but not an easy one, Francis. Iran isn't Hamas. Iran is a very large country. It has a significant military, and it can give back as well as take.
Right, you saw when Ayatollah Khamenei said that defending the Gazans, you would become a martyr. 70,000 Iranians immediately volunteered to become martyrs fighting for the Palestinians in Gaza, and then the Ayatollah had to stand them down, I think, thus showing that a lot of Iran's support for the Palestinians is public rhetoric. We know for a fact under President Khatami, that they sent over a démarche to the Bush administration, pretty much offering to settle everything on Bush's terms if they would get off the hook themselves over the nuclear question and have a normal relations. And this has always been the problem for the Palestinians. They, all their neighbors, Arab, Muslim, in the immediate vicinity, are fully prepared to sell them out if the price is right. You know, when I was at the peace talks there with Dr. Haider, we were on our own. I mean, we knew the Syrians would sell us out for the Golan. Of course, the Jordanians were happy to sell us out, too. It was just a question of timing. So the Palestinians are still on their own. You saw the Arab League could not even have a meeting and adopt a resolution. And this has always been the problem of the Palestinians, that, you know, for the last 60 years since the United Nations illegally partitioned the Palestine Mandate that was slated to be a state for all the Palestinians, they've been abandoned and betrayed by the entire world, including the United Nations. And it's very important to understand here, the UN are not the good guys. Maybe, you know, there are some very courageous, valiant UN officials over in Gaza now as we speak, trying to provide relief to the Palestinians. But the bureaucrats, the secretariat in New York, they couldn't care less. Ban Ki-moon is just a flunky for the United States. Descoto, of course, he does care. You know, he's the president of the General Assembly. I know Professor Falk, who is the UN Special Rapporteur now on Palestine, he cares. But the rest of the UN bureaucracy, they couldn't care less. For example, back in 1988, when we did the Palestinian Declaration of Independence, of course, it was originally in Arabic, which it should have been. That was how we decided. And unfortunately, the Palestinians gave it to the UN bureaucracy to translate it into the official languages of the UN. And the UN bureaucracy immediately proceeded to sabotage the translations deliberately on purpose. So the Palestinians cannot trust the UN bureaucracy, the secretariat. They're all in the pocket of the United States. They take their orders from Washington, D.C., and that's that. Same way with almost every state in the Arab League. I mean, even Gaddafi just concluded a so-called defense agreement with Washington. So I guess it's really up to international civil society, as you were suggesting, to mobilize to the defense of the Palestinians, because the governments, all these governments, have either sold them out or are prepared to sell them out if the price is right. Malaysia is not. Now, I've spent a lot of time over in Malaysia, and so far I think they've taken a pretty courageous stand under the influence of retired Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. But other than that, I regret to say the Palestinians are on their own, but they know it. I mean, they know. I've dealt with the highest Palestinian leaders, and they know all these Arab and Muslim leaders are fully prepared to sell them out as long as they get whatever they're looking for from the United States and Israel.
Oh, there's no question about it, Francis. And, of course, it's been this way for so many years. And even now, Jordan, the Saudis, Egypt, they're saying that let's have Palestinian unity under Mahmoud Abbas, and we will not deal with Hamas. And an EU representative, I forget her name, one of the ministries, I forget the precise, interior ministry of some sort, said there will be no funding to rebuild Gaza given to Hamas. Anything that will be done essentially will be coordinated under Israel's rules. Abbas may be involved, but absolutely nothing can go that may in any way allow Hamas to administer a thing. Well, Hamas is a legitimate government.
That's correct. And as the doctor pointed out, this new memorandum of understanding between the United States and Israel Basically, the United States has now entered into the conflict directly on behalf of Israel against the Palestinians. Before this, we had always been behind the scenes. But now with this agreement, we're basically going to war with Israel against the Palestinians using military force to enforce this genocidal siege of Gaza. And this does get back to the point made again by Dr. Haider Abdel-Shafi. We had long discussions about this. Dr. Haider did issue an appeal, the Palestinian Initiative, saying that the PLO must be reorganized and incorporated in there Hamas and the other Islamic movements that wanted to join it. I don't believe Islamic Jihad was interested, but Hamas first rejected it. Then they said they would. You had the prisoners document and the Mako Accord. But it's very clear now that, and the statements now made by the European Union, Merkel, and this other meeting at Sharm el-Sheikh, that the Europeans and the Americans are now going to war against the Palestinians in Gaza. There's no other word for it. And that's the dangers of this memorandum of understanding. And indeed, Bush concluded this at the last minute to try to lock Obama into this policy. And apparently, Secretary of State designate Clinton signed off on it. So I regret to say the genocidal siege of Gaza will continue.
That was my comment, Francis, that, of course, as of yesterday, we have a new president. And I've written an awful lot about him, and I refer to him as George Bush's third term. James Petras, who's been on this program several times, he wrote two important articles about Obama, and he calls him two things. He calls him the greatest con man in recent history, and he also calls him the first Jewish president. There's no question in my mind, I agree with him 100%, there's no question in my mind that Obama is fully locked in to a pro-Israel policy, and the Palestinians be damned.
That seems to be the case. Obviously he's not Jewish, but his major funders did come from the Israel lobby. Indeed, I've been publicly quoted as saying that the Democratic Party is not much more than a front organization for the Israel lobby. I'm a political independent. I'm not endorsing the Republican Party either. Indeed, I usually vote independents. But I think we have to be honest who was really behind Obama. All of his top advisors on the Middle East, Ross, Indyk, Miller, Kurzer, they're all Israel lobby people. I had a deal with Ross, Indyk, and Ross, Kurzer, and Miller at the peace negotiations. They would go in there, and later Miller was honest and admitted this. They would lie to the Palestinians about what the documents were that the State Department had drawn up on behalf of the Israelis. You can read about that in my book on the Palestinians, Palestinians and international law. They were lying to them. And indeed, eventually Miller admitted, yeah, we were spear carriers for Israel. It was a mistake. Well, you know, the same old guys are going to be back at it again. The only positive sign I've seen is that instead of appointing any of these individuals, including Haas, Obama is considering maybe appointing Senator Mitchell, and that, you know, to deal with the Middle East. And I think, you know, based on the work he did in Northern Ireland, perhaps Senator Mitchell could do something in good faith. I don't know, but any of the others, they're all Zionists. They're diehard Zionists. I've dealt with these people, and they're all in there as spear carriers for Israel. So, of course, you're not going to have any progress on any of these issues, let alone dealing with Iran, if you're appointing Zionists. And, indeed, it's simply a question of public relations management. As I found out in the 2 years I was there with Dr. Haider trying to negotiate peace in the Middle East, Israel was never interested in negotiating in good faith with the Palestinians or the or the Syrians, really, or anyone else. The whole strategy, as originally explained by Prime Minister Shamir at that time of Likud, and formerly he was the Stern Gang. There's an international arrest warrant still out for him for terrorism. He said, sure, we'll go to the peace meeting, and then we're going to stall and delay for the next 10 years. And that's what they've done ever since Madrid, stall and delay. And that's still the strategy. And all these American Zionists that have been running the Middle East peace process back them up. That's why there has been no peace. You know, it's not that it can't be figured out on paper. That was my job for the Palestinians. And I also advised the Syrian delegation during the very first round. So I was privy to, you know, where these two critical actors stood. And also to the Israeli position. So, you know, we could, if there was good faith on the part of Israel, we could have had a peace agreement, you know, between Israel, Palestine, and Syria no later than, I'd say, 1993.
Francis, we
but
have to
there
break.
There was no good faith.
We have to break again. Peace is the last thing that Israel wants. Conflict is its methodology. But let's take a break and we'll come back and finish up the hour. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Francis Boyle. Musa, I'm not certain if you're still on.
I am, yes.
Oh, you are still on. My goodness, you stayed with us.
Maybe we could have Musa give the last word here.
We just have a few minutes left. I was going to suggest that. Musa, please, your final thoughts.
Well, my final thoughts that the people here don't trust the Israelis at all in this thing about the ceasefire. They all are talking that another attack might happen soon. They will keep on intimidating Hamas to start firing rockets, and then they will say we have to defend ourselves. I just wish the United States government would stay I don't know. We don't want them to stay on our side against Israel. Just be fair, and that's all. Being fair will be on our side. And because, as Francis mentioned, this genocide has not started now. Even before 1948, we forgot about all those massacres and Deir Yassin and all the others, Kafr Qasim and all this. But yes, I hope we'll succeed to put these people on trial, because they have done so much to this to these people is unbelievable. And as I said before I go, that the people of Palestine who has survived this genocide, a lot of them will end up with lifetime psychological disorders, if not, you know, we have like 6,000 people who will have permanent handicap of one sort of another, and I still have a little bit of hope that Mr. Obama will not follow the footsteps of George Bush, because Bush administration did nothing good to the world or to the U.S. people. Actually, all what it did was killing and killing and killing, and they still supported Israel with its old doings until the last minute. And I just do hope that Mr. Obama will change this policy, as he was always promising in his campaign, change. So let's hope he will change.
Well, see, it's up to us. It's up to millions of us around the world.
That's
to keep
right.
Pushing them. It never happens from the top down. When the groundswell gets so great, that's when change comes. The history of my country, Musa, has shown that a few times there was a popular movement great enough that the politicians couldn't ignore it, and we had some, not perfect, but we had some important changes take place. So it's up to us, people all around the world, and I know I have listeners around the world, it's up to us to marshal more and more of us, spread the word, and get people to come together, not just for Palestinians, but for all oppressed people everywhere. They deserve better than that. Francis?
And also just before I go, from the interviews I had with CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera and all the others, I could feel that more and more people are supporting our problem, and they know what we're having and what we're going through, and that is just a glimpse of hope that, as you said, the pressure will hopefully will go from down up.
Jose, I need to interrupt. We're out of time. I want to thank you both for coming on. Francis, I love having you on, and I hope you'll come back. Musa, you as well.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Musa, if there's anything I can do for you, the people of Gaza, Stephen knows how to get a hold of me.
Yes, just keep supporting us, and thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you both, and we'll be back tomorrow with another program.
Thank you.
Please join us.